Okay, we're on.
We're on, okay.
I'm Kian.
And this is Chris.
And this is the next one of our potentially titled Crichton casts.
I do you like so. That? I do. How about I also suggested that let's talk about Michael.
Let's talk about Michael. We need to talk about Michael.
That's it, yeah. That's the one. That's the winner right there. So this week, we're going to be looking at... it was your second favorite after Jurassic Park?
Well, after watching it again this week, maybe even potentially my favorite, but we'll talk about that.
This is Congo.
Congo.
The adaptation, movie adaptation.
I think I particularly like Congo because nobody else does. Like, Jurassic Park is a well-respected movie, but like, you're never going to meet anyone who likes Congo, which is why I feel the need to defend it sometimes.
Yeah, I guess before we get stuck into the movie, there's a few things to mention there. So in the past week, we've had a number of big occurrences on our side. We have had one of our tweets was liked by the volunteer boy from Jurassic Park, which is Whit Hertford.
Whit Hertford, if you're out there listening, thanks for liking Chris's tweet.
Yeah, it's the zenith of fame you can get in today's social media.
Yeah, I never would have guessed that we would actually connect some way with somebody even tangentially related to Jurassic Park. That's the kid who Grant scares using the raptor claw. Yeah.
And he refrained to comment on any notion of his purpose in the movie or his backstory, but...
He just liked it.
He just liked the tweet. So I'm happy with that.
I hope we didn't say anything nasty about him in the podcast. I'm trying to remember.
I think we did. I think I thought he was a girl.
You did, yeah. I remember you weren't sure if it was a girl or a boy, but he's definitely a guy. If anyone wants to get in touch with you on Twitter, Chris, would you like to share your handle?
Yeah, I'm at Hipster for Joyce.
That's a portmanteau, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it's a Christopher Joyce with Hipster. Hipster Christopher Joyce. Anyway.
Oh, yes, I also have a pre-show announcement, and I don't know if you know this, Chris, maybe you do, but a new Michael Crichton novel has been announced.
You're kidding.
I'm not kidding. You know, only yesterday I saw this. Another novel that was almost finished has been found on his computers. So after he died, they found like the bones of two novels on his computer that have been published so far, and those are Pirate Latitudes, which is... I feel it was probably not finished because it's fun, but it feels a bit unfinished.
Yeah.
And the second one was Micro, which was completed by another writer, wasn't it?
I know Pirate Latitudes was definitely completed by another writer. I'm not so certain about Micro.
Okay.
Yeah.
But definitely this one, apparently, is even more complete. It's called Dragon Teeth.
It's more complete.
Yeah, apparently it's more complete than those two were. It's called Dragon Teeth, and it's about this thing I'm really interested in, which is called the Bone Wars. Basically, in the 19th century in America, there were these two feuding paleontologists called, and I'll see if I remember their names, Edward Drinker Cope was one of them, and the other one was a guy called Gideon Mantell. I'm not even reading these off my book, I just know this. And they were feuding about who could find the most dinosaurs. And they discovered tons of new species by trying to get one over on each other. And they were constantly, like, setting each other up. And they would actually send, like, bunches of their men, like, to go and attack the other person's dig out in Montana. So it's going to be great.
I actually remember those names from my dinosaur books.
Yeah, that's probably how I know it, too. And I've just remembered, actually, it's not Mantell, it's Marsh, Onetheo Marsh was the other guy's name.
Yeah,
Marsh and Cope were the two guys. Excellent. So that sounds like ripe fodder for a Crichton Fest.
I know.
I'm excited.
It makes me kind of think, like, is there somebody in his old house or something just, like, slowly going through his computer, seeing if they can find anything?
Like, how much more stuff could be in there that nobody knew about?
Yeah.
Maybe it's fake and someone else is writing it.
Well, he was so, like...
prolific.
Yeah, well, fearful of technology, perhaps he had it all locked up and locked away, like a vault or something.
So that's my pre-show nugget.
Yeah, are we getting any music from your folks? Maybe they can do quite frankly, I think it's atrocious.
The song that's at the beginning of Congo.
Yeah.
Do, that one.
Spirit of Africa.
Oh, it's terrible, yeah. Oh. It's awful. It's super cheesy and stereotypical.
From what I read, Keen, it was originally written by a composer whose name I can't remember now. He left the project, and someone else added some more stuff to it, and then the original guy came back and fixed it, but like, it's a tribal chant. It's supposed to be a tribal chant, and it's written by some guy in fucking Manhattan or something like that.
That's terrible.
I mean, I guess it would be like me trying to write a Mongolian
throat singing.
Yeah, or something like that. No, I could give it a go. Yeah, sure, but probably sound awful.
Well, just because you could. You know, you were so concerned as whether you could imitate Mongolian tribe throat singing, you never stopped to think about whether you should. But sadly, there's no Jeff Goldblum in this movie to say things like that.
Oh, maybe you can get your parents to do some Mongolian throat singing. All right.
Do you have any history with this movie, Chris?
Yeah, well, I mentioned in the Jurassic Park podcast when I went to see Jurassic Park, or it could have been Jurassic Park 2, or it could have been some other movie. I don't really remember. I remember seeing the Congo standee at the cinema, and I was very impressed by the standee.
What was it? Was it an actual ape, or was it something else?
I think I remember it being a big head of an ape.
Was it like Amy the Friendly Ape, or was it one of the bad apes? One of the bad gorillas?
I don't think it was either. I think it was just your regular silverback.
Okay. Gorilla. Well, I definitely saw this back in the day, and I thought it was all right. I wasn't crazy about it. There's something like definitely like second tier about it compared to Jurassic Park. It clearly didn't have the same budget. It wasn't like blowing anyone's mind with some new kind of special effects the way Jurassic Park was. But you know what? I'm kind of glad they didn't go with like 1995 CGI for the apes. That would have been horrific.
I know.
And I think that the fact that we can kind of enjoy this movie now is because they used practical effects with the creatures, because, oh man, they would have aged so badly if they'd used, yeah, like 90s CGI.
The reason they didn't use the CGI technology in Jurassic Park for Congo was because they didn't think their machines could replicate the hair on the apes well enough.
I kind of remember when Monsters, Inc. came out, apparently like some genius had to write a completely new program to be able to make the furry blue guy, his hair, to make that realistic. So like, yeah, apparently that was a challenge for a CGI artist for a long time.
Wow.
Anyway, do you remember that for a while in the 90s, or the early noughties, there was a 3-book set of Crichton books that were like everywhere. They were in like all the bookshops.
Yeah.
And it had Jurassic Park and The Lost World, and then like someone stuck Congo in there as well. It's kind of like, oh, everyone's going to want to read these two, and then we have to find another one from the old back catalogue. And I feel like no one really thought that anyone was going to care or read it, but it was totally my favorite one. It's definitely at the bottom. I mean, I like the other two as well, but Congo was definitely the book I've reread the most over the years.
Really?
Yeah, and the book meant way more to me than the movie, like when I was a teenager.
Of all the Michael Crichton movie adaptations, is Congo like the third biggest, would you think, after Jurassic Park and The Lost World?
I need to have to go back and look at how successful things like Rising Sun were, or Disclosure was big.
Oh, that was massive, actually. Yeah.
So, I mean, we obviously have more of an interest in the kind of science fiction-y ones, but he wrote a lot of straight thrillers that did very well as also.
Okay.
So I had that 3-book set, and unexpectedly, Congo was totally my favorite one. So I've reread some of it this week. I'll probably be going on my knowledge from the many rereads I've done over the years. And it's not like I think it's a better book than Jurassic Park, or like the ideas in it are better. It's just, he is speaking very directly to a thing that I love, which is like old-fashioned like jungle adventure stuff. You know,
yeah,
which is not that popular anymore. There's hardly any movies about that anymore. And you know, it's a genre that has a lot of problems, especially with like race and stuff, especially with like, you know, white people going off to like exotic places and then being better at surviving the adventures than the locals are, which is something I hate. And actually, this movie treats kind of interestingly, but I'll get into that.
Yeah, sure. I suppose another thing to mention about the book, the reason I'm very stuffy today, I'm very sneezy and stuffy, is because I went on my own expedition last night in search of not the lost city of Zinj, but
all right, did you by any chance go looking for a diamond mine of incredible bounty?
I actually went up to my attic to look for my copy of Congo, and there was a lot of dust up there. And henceforth, this is why I'm sounding a little bit stuffy on the podcast today, okay?
No diamonds, though.
No diamonds. Actually, well, I suppose we can get into the diamonds later.
We can.
All right.
So the book came out in 1980. It's set in 1979. So keep that in mind for like all the tech and stuff that's in it, and a lot of that tech, a lot of like Michael Crichton's kind of techno fetish stuff, a lot of that made it into the movie. There's quite a lot of focusing on, you know, the technology they use and all the satellite phone stuff and the, the Skyping that they do. He apparently wrote it to be a deliberate update of King Solomon's Mines, which is a H.R. Haggard book from the 1885, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the original, like, white guys go off and have adventures in Africa kind of novels. So he's very deliberately imitating that, except with tons of up-to-date 1979 technology.
I met a girl in Montreal who started writing those type of novels again, actually.
Wow.
Yeah. I must find her name. We can put it in the show notes. And
yeah, we can give her. We can give her a shout out.
Yeah.
I also found out that there's a Sega Saturn first person shooter version of this game, or version of this movie. And apparently, he sold the rights to the movie rights and all multimedia rights for the book before he'd even written it, or somebody associated with him sold the rights without him knowing it, without Michael Crichton knowing it, and then he was in trouble because he wanted to make a game. Apparently he was genuinely really interested in programming and stuff in the 80s, and he couldn't because the rights had been sold out from under him. So instead he took the story, changed like the location and stuff, and made a PC game called Amazon, where instead of being in the Congo it's in the Amazon, and instead of a talking ape there's a parrot. Apparently everything else is the same.
Oh, Jesus.
Doesn't that sound terrible?
That sounds pretty weird. There was a really interesting expedition from, I think, Chicago or somewhere that went all the way south to Panama, where you actually worked for a bit. So that could be a... Maybe...
Well, it's also mentioned in the movie that Laura Linney was good in Panama.
Oh,
she'll be good in the Congo.
Ah,
see?
That's a nice little link.
I wonder... Well, we'll talk about her CIA, mysterious CIA past. I wonder if they're referring to, like, when the CIA went into Panama in the 80s and installed the horrible dictator Noriega.
I'm not sure. Is there enough extra backstory?
No. Although, I don't think that CIA stuff is in the book either.
No.
So the movie came out in 1995.
Yep.
Production obviously stalled for about 20 years or so until they had the technology to make the apes.
What?
Apparently. Yeah. And it's directed by a guy called Frank Marshall, who has produced lots of big-time movies. Like, he worked with Spielberg a lot, and he's been involved in lots of the Indiana Jones movies and stuff. But he directed very few other movies, although one he did direct was Arachnophobia. Have you seen that?
Oh, God. that was the movie that was to be scared. That was the movie that instilled fear into it, like a 13-year-old.
Yes. One thing about that movie is that a lot of the jungle scenes are on sets, right? They're supposed to be outdoors, but they're sets. And they have this kind of slightly unreal feel about them, and I think Congo has that feel a lot when they're on sets that are clearly indoors but they're supposed to be outdoors. It's not that it's unbelievable, it just has this kind of fantasy kind of unreality to it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's okay, sometimes it's kind of distracting in this movie. And it wasn't well received by comparison with Jurassic Park, because obviously that had blown everyone's minds with this new technology, and Congo didn't really try out anything new with the technology, except, you know what, I prefer that they used, you know, men in suits instead of CGI for the apes.
Was there any, real animals in this movie?
All the apes were people in costumes.
All of them?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Were you fooled?
Like one or two times, I was fooled. I
thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, there was one or two times I wasn't able to distinguish between them.
Well, you know what I think about Amy? It's she's like the main good ape. It's not so much that she looks realistic. It's more like you buy her as a character. You buy into it as she's a character. And I was kind of like thinking about Chewbacca in Star Wars. You know, when Chewbacca comes on the screen, part of your brain just kind of switches off and accepts him as a character instead of being hypercritical about like whether he looks real, because I mean he doesn't. Like, Chewbacca doesn't look like a real creature, but you know, you're like, hey, it's Chewbacca, instead of, oh, I'm criticizing the effects here.
Yeah, that's a thing I've always thought about movies for a long, long time. If something doesn't exist anyway, how do you know to make it look real to the person? Like, so for instance, I mean,
gorillas are real, so it's much harder to fool someone with a gorilla costume.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So we'll go through some notes and things that we thought about this movie. It starts off with that horrible song you mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't seen Congo for years, and I haven't read Congo for years, and I turned it on this week, and I just heard that song, and it's just like, what? the hell am I after getting myself?
And it opens up with some stuff that looks like stock footage. Really looks like stock footage of here is Africa, here are some giraffes, and here are some.
No, I have that here as well, and there could have been, if they just didn't use the zoom on the camera, it wouldn't look like bad stock.
I'm not sure that it is stock footage because there's like these jeeps are going through the landscape, and then later on the characters actually, actors actually do come out of the jeeps. So I don't think it is stock footage. It just looks like it.
Yeah, I think it's just the way it's filmed really makes it look like.
And actually, some of the scenery later on is much nicer and much better done. That opening is just really bad. And so I thought immediately, hey, we're off to a bad start here. But then who comes out of the jeep? Only Bruce Campbell. Yeah. And I was thinking then, hey, we're off to a good start.
Yeah, we're in. I suppose just to fill what's in on the location here, where it says on a door, actually, Le Volcan de Virunga.
We're in the Virunga region of the country that was then called Zaire, which is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
And there's a sign in on the door that says, porters are 350 francs per day.
In French.
Yeah, in French.
And the reason people are using French is because the Congo was controlled by not Belgium itself, but their King Leopold. He owned like all of the Congo personally. Mm. It was his own colony. He was a rather awful and extraordinary individual. So a lot of people in the Congo speak French for that reason.
The thing I find funny about this opening scene is that the group just basically, it all happens so quickly. It looks like they just start walking off into the
yeah, they get there in no time at all.
Yeah.
Whereas then later in the movie, we have to watch the second expedition like taking ages to get there.
Yeah. They just walk off into the.
And they find the lost city without really looking for it or like without any hassle.
Yeah.
It's a bit weird. Anyway, if you don't know who Bruce Campbell is, he's in the old Evil Dead movies. And they're about as funny as they are scary. And it's a lot of it is down to him. He's a very goofy, he's got a goofy face and a goofy voice, and he really hams it up in this. I usually like seeing him in movies. Apparently he went for the male lead in this, and they gave him this, like, throwaway role instead.
I really wish he was the male lead, because I really don't like that Peter.
You didn't like Peter Elliott? Well, when Bruce Campbell actually gets some lines at the beginning of this, I was reminded as to like kind of why he never really made it. He's a very hammy actor. He is fun in a campy kind of a movie, but this movie teeters constantly on the edge of like silliness.
Yeah,
I mean, to have him as the main character would just like tip it over the edge, I think.
I mean, a lot of it's really, really funny, but man, sometimes it's almost like every second line is a joke. Or there's what, five characters there that provide comic humor.
Yeah, that's right. We'll get to that. Anyway, the music swells, and as they walk up to the mountains, and the scenery and the landscape shots do get a lot better very quickly once they go up the mountain. And I was really taken away, and it was like, oh, I really want to be like go on an expedition, because that's what this movie and the book means to me. It's like an early example of a story that I loved when I was younger about like guys going on adventures, and then immediately it cuts to a stupid, obvious looking stage set pretending to be the jungle, and I was like, oh yeah.
Yeah. Mount Mukenko.
Mount Mukenko, yes. And then they cut to the satellite in space. It's not as bad as the one from GoldenEye, but
it's not bad.
It's not bad.
Another thing, like, I don't know what it's like to look at a satellite in space, so I
probably
guess
not like the bad CGI one from GoldenEye.
No, this works for me. It's fine. Yeah. But basically, Bruce Campbell is off looking to find a blue diamond, really for his communications company, which is run by his father.
I don't know what the connection is between the diamonds and the laser and communications. I read that section in the book today, and I'm not going to bother explaining it to you, because Michael Crichton goes into way too much. Like, I mean, he likes his technology and his science, but it doesn't matter. It's a MacGuffin. The diamonds are just, they're looking for the diamonds. That's all you have to worry about.
Yeah. Interesting note about these diamonds that they used in the movie, actually, they actually borrowed them from a mine in, I think, upstate New York.
Yes.
For this movie.
Yeah, I read that.
And they needed diamonds that looked that big or whatever, and looked like diamonds, actually. And at the end of the movie, they throw a diamond off the balloon they're in. And that was, they in reality lost that diamond, and they couldn't return it back to the mine.
I was fully expecting a scene where it turned out that Ernie Hudson like had stashed a whole bunch of diamonds in his pockets. Like, I was waiting for it, and maybe it's in the book, I can't remember, but or maybe I just made that up. But it doesn't happen in the movie, sadly.
Oh, right. Well,
what happens to Bruce Campbell and his team?
Oh yeah. It's a typical horror movie
opening.
Yeah. They go off wandering, they go diving in a pond or a lake or a moat. We won't mention moats.
Don't talk about moats.
No. And I guess they find the lost city of Zinj pretty just like haphazardly. And
so it's just by chance, isn't it, that the place where they have to go for the diamonds happens to be the lost city? Like the company they work for, which is Travicom, it's called something else in the book. They don't care about the city. They just need diamonds, and they think they're going to find diamonds in this volcano range. Mm-hmm. And there happens to be a lost city there. So Bruce Campbell's team isn't looking for it or anything. They just stumble across it.
Yeah.
And what else do they stumble across, Chris?
I don't know. It's somewhere between a really old person and an ape. What is it?
It's an ape. They're just apes that have been bred, you know, to be really vicious by the people who lived in the lost city a long time ago.
Oh, really? That's it?
Yeah, okay. They mentioned that later on.
When
they're like inside the lost city, they're reading somehow Tim Curry manages to like transcribe the hieroglyphics, and they tells him that the apes have been trained and bred to be vicious.
At that point, when I was watching the movie, I actually stopped the movie exactly when Tim Curry deciphered those, and I went off and looked at Wikipedia to find out something I wanted to know. So there you go. That's why lost on me.
So Bruce Campbell and his team are in trouble. They're being killed and beaten up by something, but you don't really see it yet.
It throws
eyeballs at them. And then it cuts to Travicom, and their base is in Houston. And it looks like a real rinky-dink kind of an organization. Like, in the book, it's explicitly described as, like, this massive organization that, like, has several teams, like, in all these far-flung parts of the world at any one time. And there's a huge control room with, like...
40,000 employees.
Yeah, he does say that, but they never show it. Because, like, in the movie, it just looks like this one little dark room with Travis and his golf clubs. And then the main female lead is Laura Linney, who I really like. She never really... I don't feel like enough people know her, or she was ever in a really big movie that everyone knew, but she was in a HBO series called John Adams, which is great. It's got Paul Giamatti playing John Adams, who was the second American president, and it includes like the Civil War and his presidency, and she's his wife, and she's in it like just as much as he is. And both Paul Giamatti and Laura Linney are great. And she's just someone who I feel never really got her due. And she's a lot of fun in this. I mean, some of her dialogue at the beginning especially is terrible. But then I really hate the subplot with her and Travis.
It feels
really fake. That's not in the book at all, actually.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier. Michael Crichton doesn't really force his main characters together if he thinks that they're supposed to be together.
Yeah, he doesn't. Like, a lot of adventure movies and books, the leads just get together always, just because that's what you do. And Crichton's, like, not interested in this. He sometimes hints at it. Like, we're not, like we said in Jurassic Park, we're not totally sure if they're supposed to be together. And in this movie, it's barely hinted at. There's that one scene where the apes are, you know, Ernie Hudson delivers that monologue about, like, apes mating and stuff. Okay. And they almost have a moment where you think it might go that way, but then it doesn't. And I kind of like that. I like the way he doesn't force it. I mean, you get the idea that, especially in the book, that they get to respect each other. They come to respect each other and they like each other in some way. But he's very explicit in a lot of his books. Like, afterwards, the characters don't get together. No, I think the main two in Jurassic Park, is it mentioned in The Lost World that they like get married to other people or something? I feel like I remember that. Anyway.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Anyway, she's great. So she's in the control room looking at the carnage in the Congo where Bruce Campbell's team have been cut up. And then there's a really weird bit where another technician is coming in, and in order to get into the control room, he's got to like deliver this weird password.
Yeah.
And it's Rudy, 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 which is just like someone's name in the control room. Remember that?
Yeah, I do. Like, who is Rudy? I don't know.
No, they do mention it. He's one of the other guys who's in the... He's one of the low-level technicians. And it's like... Does he like the Kaiser Chiefs, but he gets the lyrics wrong, you know?
Yeah, I suppose... in this little dark control room, anyway, the head of the company is... watching Bruce Campbell. No, actually, they pick up the feed, actually.
Yes, they talk to him before he gets killed.
Yeah.
And he does, he actually, oh, he does the worst scream ever when he gets killed. It's, he like, he does a really classic Bruce Campbell thing, which is like, look at the camera and take a second and open, bug your eyes really wide, and then go, which is like, fine in like Sam Raimi movies and stuff, but mm-hmm. I don't know, it really tips this one towards the camp end of things.
Mm-hmm. And the owner of the company, I don't know.
Travis. Because it's Travicom.
He goes mental.
Yeah.
And basically just, he has a golf club or something.
Yeah, he does, yeah. Doesn't he come into the building on a golf cart?
Oh, yeah, he does.
So he's come from golfing somewhere. Now, they keep trying to pretend like it's a huge company because the exterior shots of the building make it look huge. But then you never see more than just this one tiny control room.
Yeah.
With like a staff of like three people.
Yeah, I suppose a small side note as well. It's supposed to be in Houston, and you can see all these mountains in the background, but there's no mountains near Houston.
Oh, they also have shots of, like, massive telescope, you know, radio telescopes, and that's clearly, like, from, like, you know, SETI or something. That's nothing to do with this company. Yeah. Total stock footage. It's funny. So they pan the camera to check out the carnage, and it gets into a little bit of the technology, like the techno stuff that Crichton loves, and it shows him, you know, turning that ball and moving the camera around remotely, which, you know, would have been pretty cool in 1995 and would have been way, like, really impressive in 1979.
Oh, yeah.
When the book was written.
Yes. And so he gets really pissed off that his expedition has failed in search of the diamonds, and he's really just, like, he
smashes a TV screen with the golf club.
Yeah. Cathode ray tube TV screen as well. And, like, there's no... He doesn't hide the fact that he's just only interested in getting the diamonds and that he's not interested in recovering his son, Bruce Campbell.
And to me, that was done really... Like, he's such a cartoon villain.
Yeah.
Like, he behaves... It's stupid. And it's all set up to have this tension between him and Laura Linney, and I didn't really... Yeah. I didn't buy it.
So he sends Laura off to the Congo with... Like, he promises to her... that he's only sending her out there to look for Bruce Campbell. You know, that comes up later, I guess. But
they have some video evidence of what did the carnage on it. They think it might be a gorilla, but they're not sure.
Yeah.
And she has to do some... Well, in the book, she has to do a bunch of... Like, Michael Crichton spends a whole page explaining to you, like, how she, you know, used all these computer programs to enhance the footage and stuff. Because, you know, it was 1980 and people... He was trying to impress people with that. Like, how she uses all these proto-Photoshop things. Nice. But do you notice the bit where she says, like, it's a gorilla, and then he straight away is like, girls don't do that. Like, why, what, how come he knows about gorillas? And then later on in the movie, he says something like, he's on the Skype to her, and he says, like, my primatologist tells me that blah, blah, blah. What kind of company is this that you have a primatologist?
And maybe they just wanted to shoehorn that term in there.
Oh, no, that term will be coming along later in a piece of immortal dialogue.
So,
She also says that she almost married Bruce Campbell.
Yeah.
And, like, what, that plot never goes anywhere.
No.
Like, she was with him, they nearly got married, and then she's not that interested in getting him back. Like, it's not like she's in love with him, and then when she does find him later and he's dead, it's, you know, she's upset, but it's not a big deal, so I don't know why they left that in there.
Yeah, and, she basically says to, God, what's his name again?
Peter Elliott?
No. Head of the company.
Oh, Travis.
Travis, yeah.
Think of Travis from Home and Away.
Oh, okay, yeah. I know.
Does that help?
It does.
I thought it might.
She says to him, would you not be like human or something?
Oh, yeah.
Try and be human. And he says, I'll be human later.
I wrote that down as well. All right.
So we're off to Berkeley, California, and we see a lot of 90s kids. Okay. A lot of 90s grungy people. Startup.
You can tell it's the 90s because Peter Elliott, the primatologist, has got Doom on his Macintosh. Did you write that down? Yeah, he's playing Doom. In fact, nobody is playing Doom. It's just like running a demo or something.
Mm. Yeah, why would you?
Why would you leave that
Doom
running?
Because
it's 1995. And we meet Peter Elliott. He's a primatologist, and he's working with Amy, who's a mountain gorilla. and he's teaching her how to talk using sign language.
Is there a difference between a mountain gorilla and a greyback gorilla?
Silverback gorilla is like what you call a male mountain gorilla. Oh. When they, it's a sign of maturity when they get that grey colour, silver colour in their back. So it just shows that they're the... There's a Gary Larson cartoon where the, all these mountain gorillas are, like, in a locker room in high school. And, like, they're all... They're changing in, after being in the showers, after doing, like, PE. And one ape looks at the other one. He's like, oh, that guy's already a silverback.
For the uninitiated, Keane is, of course, a zoologist, or a resident zoologist here on the cast.
I don't know too much about apes, though. I haven't done more than that. So, Peter Elliott and his goofy companion, he's got his sidekick. I don't remember his name.
Yeah, he's like the fifth guy who provides some form of comic relief.
Yeah, he's not in it too much. I didn't like him, but he wasn't in it very much. He doesn't get a lot of lines. Anyway, they have to give a presentation about how they have got Amy to talk using sign language and how he's equipped her with this kind of cybernetic device that allows... It's like a computer that is on her hand and her back, and then it vocalizes the signs that she makes with a computer-y voice.
It's basically motion tracking for your hands, and so any sign language that you make will be translated into...
Yeah.
Audio.
What did you think about that weird fat guy in the audience?
Who's like Mr. Ed.
Yeah, this isn't Mr. Ed. Like, it focuses on him, like, way too much, and it goes nowhere.
Again, it's just like another gag thrown into this.
The tone is really weird at times, isn't it?
It's been a very goofy movie, and there's so much comic relief.
So I have to say, so far, I wasn't super impressed with it. Like, I was having fun with it, but I wasn't really enjoying it. Like, and it was kind of, some of the dialogue here is bad, the setup is cheesy, and like, the tension is bad. But then Tim Curry comes into it. And Tim Curry, I don't know whose idea this was, because he's not in the book. I'm not going to try and say his name, but he's a Romanian philanthropist.
It's his name, and the same name as the diamond mine that they borrowed the diamonds off.
Oh. His name is Homolka. His last name is Homolka.
Herman Homolka.
It's not Herman. It's something way goofier than that.
He's from Romania, where he has escaped the chains of Ceausescu.
Oh, yeah, he says that. And he pronounces Ceausescu really strangely as well. So he's a really horrible stereotype of an Eastern European. And he's super greedy, and he lies about everything, and he's... untrustworthy, and he's a bit slimy.
That said, though, right, he, in comparison to the technology company, he seems to actually also have a bit of an interest in the hieroglyphics.
Yeah, he's a scientist of sorts.
Yeah,
he's a bit of an Indiana Jones, actually, because he's looking for the lost city, but he doesn't tell anybody yet. He's not as bad. It's implied that he's some kind of criminal, and other characters keep making reference to like shady things he's done in the past.
Yeah.
He's a bit of a Han Solo that way, but he's never seen really doing anything bad, except that he's very single-minded about trying to find the city.
Yeah, and I suppose towards the end he does get very greedy for the diamonds, but he's also interested in actually finding the city, like the adulation of that.
He's not played out as a totally bad character.
No. So he has a theory that Amy knows where the lost city of Zinj is. There's a story where he found a map in Georgia or something like that.
Yes.
And that brought him to find this gold ring that had a golden eye on it.
A symbol, yeah.
That's basically his entire story. So he's looking for that based on.
And he notices from like a magazine article about Peter Elliott and Amy that Amy has been having nightmares and has been finger painting the same image.
Yeah.
So she's painting all these pictures of a jungle with the eye symbol, and Tim Curry's like, oh, that's the same symbol that I saw in the pictures of Zinj. So he thinks that she has been there and remembers it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why. But he doesn't tell anybody that for a while.
So he agrees to front the cost of...
Well, he pretends like he could front the cost. It then turns out at the airport that he can't pay for the fuel.
Yeah, it's... Jimmy Buffett who's flying the plane.
Yes, it is. I didn't notice that at the time, actually.
Me neither. Oh, God.
Jimmy Buffett is the pilot.
Jeez. So, Yeah, he decides to fork up. Well, there's not really a whole lot here, is there?
Well, there is the fact that at this point, Karen Ross, who is Laura Linney's character, shows up. And in fact, she turns out to be the one who's bankrolling them. And she's like, I need to join your expedition. Now, this is explained a bit better in the book. It turns out that visas for his... Because I was thinking at first, well, why does she need to go on this plane with this guy? Like, can't Travis is like megabucks. Can't he just like get her to... the Congo any way he needs to? Why does she have to go this way? But in the book it explains, like, it's really hard to get visas for Zaire. They need to get them quickly and no questions asked. And because Elliot's team already has, like, visas and is legally allowed to go there and travel and all their insurance is covered, it's easier for her to go with this expedition that's already kind of sorted. So that's why she turns up and says, hey, I'll pay for everything, when it turns out that... Tim Curry was lying about the money. And there's a great piece of immortal dialogue when Elliot's like, you know, you can't buy me off. She says, what's your price? And he says, I don't have a price. I'm not a pound of sugar. I'm a primatologist. Did you have that written down?
I did.
I hope to be able to use that phrase somehow in my life.
Mm-hmm. So I guess they... This is where the journey begins.
Yeah, this is when it gets better. I really started enjoying it. Well, after that awful scene in the airplane with the bad dialogue and the William Butler Yeats quote.
Oh, yeah, it's from was it Irish Airman or something like that.
An Irish Airman foresees his death, yeah. Well, I actually like that poem.
Yeah, lonely impulse of delight.
Yes. And she's using her, like, suitcase-sized laptop inside the plane he accuses her of being a geek because she has a cellular phone.
Yeah.
Because it's 1995.
They start mentioning the killer ape myth here, which I suppose kind of expands throughout the rest of the movie nicely. Do you want to talk about that? Or
All I have to say is that for a movie that spends quite a bit of time at the beginning, you know, saying that, hey, you know, gorillas are really gentle and we shouldn't be scared of them, and then it turns out to actually be literally a killer ape movie, they could have spent a bit more time on the fact that the killer apes are evil because they've been trained by people, you know, for reasons of greed. Like, they mentioned that, but I would have preferred, it would have been a bit more responsible for them to hammer that home a little bit more,
yeah,
I thought.
Yeah, I would agree. I suppose this is the thing that gets me. How are we on time there?
We're fine.
This thing that gets me on an awful lot of movies. She's kind of hiding the fact that she's going out there to search for Bruce Campbell.
Like, yes.
Because she, I don't know why. Is it the fact that she's already just paid for all of their fuel? Why doesn't she just say, like, look, I'm out here doing this. What's all the secrecy about that?
Again, in the book, it's a bit more clear. The company she works for, you know, is in competition with all these other companies. And, you know, it's like not industrial, but what's the phrase we used when we were talking about Nedry stealing the DNA?
Subterfuge.
Yeah, there's kind of double dealings going on.
Okay. And yeah, I guess maybe later in the movie when they're on the boats as well, her uncle does come out with why he's on the expedition for real. And everyone was just like, yeah, whatever. Okay.
Yeah, well, I feel like he just didn't want to talk about it because he was getting so much crap off Ernie Hudson the whole time. So then they land in Central Africa. No particular, non-specific.
No?
No, they just said Central Africa.
Really?
And the reason I think they're being non-specific is because they're not in Zaire yet. They're in some neighboring country because there's all this fuss about getting over the border, right? Zaire has shut its borders. They keep saying that because of problem. The country they've landed in is like kind of stereotypically treated and is undergoing a coup is full of like stereotypically corrupt African bureaucrats. So like I can see why they didn't want to name any particular country here.
Fair enough. Okay. And basically they arrive in the airport and all hell is breaking loose. The president's car is after exploding. They're bustled onto the back of an army transport vehicle.
Oh, they meet Eddie Ventro first.
Eddie Ventro.
Yeah.
He's Hawaiian.
He's another comedy relief character. I actually really liked him. Like, I feel like that actor was cool and I wanted to see more of him.
Yeah, he didn't end up going on the expedition with them.
No, he doesn't. He no... But he does say that the money hairs on the back of his neck are going up. Woo, woo, woo.
Is there a line around this time as well that they mention Kafka?
Yes, this is one of my favorite parts. So when they're being driven around the airport by Eddie Ventro, he's saying things like, oh, we're on our third government in 2 years, which in a way is like, he's like, you know, welcome to Africa. And in a way, I'm like, oh, that's really stereotypical. But, you know, some Central African countries have had, like, periods that are very like that. And it's not a ridiculous exaggeration, I would say, in some ways. At this point, I noted that we still have had no African characters. Like, everyone they meet is, like, American or something. And it takes a while before this movie's kind of position on, like, treating race in like, an African movie comes clear. But they have that fantastic bit of dialogue where Elliot is hoping to be hooked up with some leader who's going to take them into the jungle. This guy called Robertson Reynolds. And Ventura's like, yeah, I fired him. And he's like, what? But no, why did you fire him? He's like, Robertson Reynolds is a bird watcher. And he's like, but I hired Robertson Reynolds. And he goes, you would. And then he, like, lectures him about, like, how much of a mess this country's in. And, like, how he doesn't know what he's getting into. And, again, it's all kind of stereotypical stuff, but it's fun, it's well done. The pace really picks up from here on.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
And he's talking about cannibals and corruption, and he, like, stamps all their passports for them and goes, like, well, it's not easier than going through customs.
It is good, it's good, it good takes, fun, yeah. Right?
And then they meet Ernie Hudson.
Ernie Hudson, who says that this was the most enjoyable role of his career, apparently.
Well, he looks like he's having a great time doing it.
Yeah, and his voice just, like, transcends this, like, everything else in the movie. You just hear his voice.
He really brings it up. He takes everything up a notch. He's better than everything else around him. Like, he says at one point, you're in better hands than you deserve.
He's his voice reminds me of Darth Vader, James Earl Jones.
Jones. Where do you think he's supposed to be from in this movie?
I'm sure he's supposed to be British, isn't he?
He sounds like, it was such a bad British accent that I'm not sure. Like, yeah. Is he, like, a British person living in Africa? Is he an African who, like, grew up in a British colony?
Okay.
I don't know. It's never really explained.
I guess not.
But he's great. He's, like, he takes charge immediately. He's like, charming and knowledgeable, and he knows everything about this part of Africa, and he always knows the right thing to do. He's really calm, and he's a great leader. Like, whenever someone has a breakdown, he always deals with it in, like, a really effective way. Mm-hmm. And I just really liked him a whole lot. And, like, he I don't know, it kind of turns around the politics of this movie. Like, a lot of adventure movies that take place in, like, foreign places, like, you know, like the Mummy movies or something.
Yeah.
Like Egypt or Africa or whatever, is always, or India in Indiana Jones, they're always treated as, like, this, like, glamorous exotic place for the white characters to go and have adventures, and the locals, you know, well, the movie doesn't usually focus too much on them, or it turns out that the white hero is better at everything than they are, like, especially in the Mummy movies, where the Arab characters are always, like, cowards and they're always getting killed really easily. And this is a bit more interesting because Ernie Hudson turns up and says, I'm your great white hunter, but I happen to be black. he's so funny and charming.
It's great. It's
yeah.
Great.
It makes me doubly sad again about that he was kind of not used enough in Ghostbusters, which is his other big role. He was Winston Zeddemore. Like, he's not one of the main Ghostbusters. He shows up late in the movie. We don't spend that much time with him. And he's clearly a really great actor.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. There's many other, like, great, well, actors with great, other roles in this movie, actually, if you have a look at some of their IMDb repertoire.
So then we get the interrogation scene, and again, this is kind of more stereotypical, messed up African country stuff, but, you know, I'm sure stuff like this probably does happen sometimes. But they're locked up by the police, and there is that funny scene where the nerdy psychic guy is like, this is so Kafka, and then the chief of police guy is like, who is Kafka? Tell me! And that made me laugh. Mm-hmm. And then they go to the Hotel Leopold to meet this, some kind of warlord guy. Or he's some kind of military commander, maybe.
Hotel Leopold.
Yes.
Leopold. Would that give a clue to where we are, might be?
So Leopold was the king of the Belgians in, like, the 1890s, and he owned all of what is now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Mm. But there are Hotel Leopolds all over the world. Like, I've been to a Hotel Leopold in Mumbai and stuff. So,
okay.
I mean, that doesn't... We're still not in Zaire. We could be in... I don't know. My knowledge of, like, what those countries were called in 1995 is not great.
Right.
I don't want to make a guess. But, yeah, what did you think about that scene with this guy?
The interrogation scene or the scene where they're brought to...
The scene with the sesame cake. The infamous sesame cake scene.
It's really good. The guy who plays the captain...
Oh, I can't remember. I tried to catch his name, but I missed it.
Yeah, he's uncredited in the movie, but he's got a load... Yeah.
He's a great actor. I was knocked out by that scene. I thought he was... Again, he was funny, but he was brutal when he needed to be. And he struck me as, like... This is an intelligent guy making his way in a very corrupt world. Mm. They didn't turn him into just like an evil African dictator guy. He was, you know, he was taking bribes, but he had good insight into like the hypocrisy of the West and the corruption in his own country. And I liked him.
And how they'd only get across the border with the ape. And
the implication that like the ape was more important than any human lives because... Oh, Americans will pay attention to, like, the ape, but they won't pay attention to, like, Africans killing each other.
Yeah.
So there's some deep stuff going on here in the midst of a really goofy scene with another piece of immortal dialogue.
Stop eating my sesame cake.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
It's such a weird, goofy moment.
There's, like, loads of YouTube mashups with that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we'll have to have a look at those.
I also liked how, and this is cheesy old school Hollywood stuff, but he's familiar both with Ernie Hudson and with Tim Curry's characters. Like, they both have shady pasts, and they've been mixed up with these really unscrupulous characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I just liked it.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
Yeah. And then we meet the Porters, who are a guy called Kahega and his men. Mm-hmm. And I like them as well. They're not in it too much, but they're in it a bit more than you'd expect, like, you know, the background local characters to be. Like, they're consistently portrayed as being really smart and competent and generally cheerful and good at their job and brave. Like, they're always, anytime they're exploring dangerous new places in the jungle or in the Lost City, one of those guys is at the front. Mm-hmm. And you learn a little bit more about them than you generally do about those kind of characters in movies.
Yeah, for sure. We'll get to some of that later, I guess. They do seem, like, there is a, would you agree there's a kind of underlying theme of communication in this?
Yeah.
As in...
I like, yeah, that's a good...
They do sing at certain points, like, in their own language, and then in, like, you know, what was that?
The song?
The song that...
They sing... Excuse me. It's mentioned in the book that the language they're speaking is Swahili, which is kind of like a mix between Arabic, you know, and some African languages that was common all across Central Africa. And the song they sing is California Dreamin' by the Mamas and the Papas.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a great... For me, I actually wrote that down as one of my three great subversive moments. And I just like it because later on in the movie, is it Elliot starts singing it to Amy? And then unexpectedly, all the Porters join in.
Yeah.
And they're like, they're really good at it. And they've got all different parts worked out. There's harmonies going on. And it's just like a great moment that kind of says, you don't know anything about these people. Like, you can't presume anything. And, you know, you might think you know what to expect from this kind of character or this kind of person. And that's all bullshit because you don't know anything. And why wouldn't a bunch of Swahili Porters in Central Africa know this song, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just messing with expectations of people's roles in life and in Hollywood movies as well. There's a few times when this movie gets above its genre, I think.
Yeah, for sure. A bit like, Starship Troopers.
Starship Troopers, yeah, big time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they bribe their way out of it. And, they're on their way to Tanzania?
Yeah, now this is the first country that's actually named. We don't know where they were previously because I don't think the filmmakers wanted to name this president-murdering country.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's odd because it's like a lot of the important stuff is kind of discussed in this country, but you never find out where it is.
Yeah, I guess they're kind of saying, well, it could be anywhere because most of Central Africa is messed up, which is... a bit reductionist, but also kind of sad.
Yeah.
So they meet Kahega and his men. Oh, there's that weird confrontation between Ernie Hudson and Tim Curry, where Tim Curry, like, almost said something really nasty to him. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
I never noticed that before watching this. And he's like, shut up, you filthy. And then he doesn't say it. And then Ernie Hudson, like, makes it clear that, like, you do not mess with him. But then immediately afterwards, he's like, he's all cheerful and polite again. And he's like, yep, all right, we're rolling up the sleeves, getting back to it.
Yeah.
He's very professional in this, you know? There's no messing with him, but I liked his character. The movie really gets taken over by him and, to some extent, Tim Curry. And the supposed main characters get sidelined, especially Elliot, because he's kind of wussy.
Yeah, I really don't like Elliot. I just don't.
I don't dislike him, but I feel like he's there so that, you know, Hollywood suits think that ordinary white Americans have someone to root for or to feel comfortable with.
Oh.
Did you think that?
I wasn't thinking too deep when I was watching this movie. The expectations dropped significantly in the first, you know, 30 seconds.
Because of the sun.
Yeah.
So there's a scene where they're flying and they get shot down by the Zaire Air Force because the Zaire has shut its borders and no one's supposed to be going in there.
Yeah.
And Ross, who's Laura Linney, becomes a total badass and, like, kicks open this door while they're in the air and, like, starts shooting flares to, like, distract all the missiles.
Apparently that wouldn't
really work.
Be feasible in real life, but I wouldn't take it. It's cool.
I thought it was cool. She really takes charge here. And, like, from this point on, she knows what she's doing. She's really action-orientated. And she, like, there's that great shot where her and Ernie Hudson, Monroe, are, like, sticking their hands out the window, shooting the guns. And, like, the guy who you thought was going to be the hero was, like, probably peeing himself somewhere at the back. And, like, these two have really taken charge.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and then Kahega, he's the leader of the porters. He's, like, having a great time. Kicking everyone out the door when they have to parachute out.
Yeah.
And he's, like, laughing and kicking people out. And again, some of that attic dust.
Yeah.
Laura Linney just, like, runs out the door. No one has to kick her because she's a badass.
Yeah, the thing that I really hate about these sort of movies, these adventure movies. Okay, so they were the first plane they were on. They had, like, loads and loads and loads of luggage and equipment.
Yeah.
And then you don't even see it being taken off the plane when they land in the war-stricken country.
Oh, yeah, because only, like, they get into a tiny little vehicle.
Yeah.
That's true.
And then
later on, they have their equipment whenever they need it.
Yeah, and then they're jumping off the plane in parachutes, and they have, what, 3 or 4 boxes?
Yeah.
They probably land, you know, 6 feet.
And what happened to the pilots? There's 2 pilots. It's mentioned that they bail.
Yeah.
And they're surely hundreds of miles from anywhere.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Just wandering around in the jungle. Yeah, we never see them again.
Yeah.
So, do you
not find that annoying that, like, they're parachuting boxes out of the plane that are probably landing, like, kilometers away from each other?
Yeah. And that happens in the book, actually. They spend a bit more time explaining, like, yeah, they do have to go and retrieve all their stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
So, I mean, Crichton is good for details like that. He doesn't make goofs. A movie has less time to, like, focus on those kind of details, so it kind of plays fast and loose. I guess if you wanted to, you could imagine that when they were taken out of the first airplane, like, someone else came and took their stuff and put it into the truck or something, and they just didn't bother showing you because...
I have written down here in my notes, I hate the Ape Man.
Who's the Ape Man?
Yeah, it's Peter Eddie.
All right. Yeah, he's a wuss. He actually has a moment after they land from the parachutes where he's like, yeah, I give up. And then Monroe has to be like, dude, you're in the middle of the jungle. Where do you think you're going to go?
Yeah. People die around here very quickly.
Yeah. I like that scene as well. Because he's like, I don't know, he's realistic. He's like, look, this is where we are. These are the dangers. This is the reality. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but you should make the right decision. He's a good leader, like. Then they have that horrible, this really troubled me when I was a kid. Because up to this point, like, when I was a kid, I'd be like, oh, yeah, can't wait to go on a jungle adventure. That looks class. But then there's that scene. I can't believe this bothered me out of everything. You know, where they're walking in the rain and, like, there's loads of mud. The tents are opening when they don't want them to and they're falling around in the mud. I was like, oh, that looks awful. I don't want to do that.
And all their stuff gets dirty.
Yeah.
What the hell? There's a part after this I spotted, and maybe you can maybe inform me a little bit more on this, but I've always been told that apes and monkeys eat bananas by pinching the top.
I've heard that too, yeah. I don't know if it's true.
And they eat it, but like, I've seen photos of gorillas and stuff eating bananas like that.
Yeah.
But there's, I spotted a part where Amy actually eats a banana by just like breaking it in half and just.
She's not a real gorilla though, Chris. I'm sorry.
I've been fooled again.
Sorry to break it to you. I have heard that, and I don't know if it's true.
Okay.
Then they meet the ghost tribe. I was scared of them as a kid.
Yeah, I mean, like, I did some, like, not a lot of research. I pretty much typed ghost tribe into Google, and nothing came up. So I'm guessing they're not real.
I don't think they are, no.
It's a bit weird. I mean, like, they're kind of like, don't let them know that you've seen them or something like that, and then they just walk out and they're just like, oh,
it's fine. That's because Ernie Hudson talks to them and he delivers another of those great subversive moments. He says ghost tribe people are laughing for some reason, mm-hmm. and someone says, what are they laughing at? And he's like, because I told them I'm in charge. And they're like, why is that funny? He says, because I'm black, I should have luggage in my head. And it's just another fantastic role reversal moment, and it kind of shows that someone who made this had some ideas about, like, dealing with ideas about race in movies that was a bit more sophisticated than the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it made me laugh anyway.
So the ghost tribe are after finding... Well, I've also seen them being referenced as shadow people, but...
In the movie?
No, in... No, someone was talking about the movie.
Oh.
Called them shadow people. They have Bob Driscoll, who was one of the people that was on the original expedition with Bruce Campbell.
Was he in the first scene with Bruce Campbell? Is that the same guy?
I don't think it's the same person. Okay. Because no. Remember, the guy's eyeball is taken out.
Oh, that's true. And this guy definitely has both his eyeballs.
Yeah, for sure. You can definitely see that. So basically, the ghost tribe are trying to resurrect him because they have different layers of death.
Yes. Again, Michael Crichton spends like a whole page explaining that in the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
He goes into loads of detail about like cultural stuff. It's really interesting.
Nice.
And it just survives as like a single line of dialogue in the movie. But there you go, yeah.
Yeah, and they almost have him back, and all his supposed friends just kill him again with the shock. Yeah. Like he sees Amy.
He sees Amy, yeah. That scared me as a kid, the scene where he sees Amy, and like he's so traumatized by whatever happened to him that he dies of fright. I thought that I was really impressed by that when I was a kid.
Yeah,
I was.
There's music. Is there some music after this?
I think that's when the California Dreaming bit happens.
That's what I wrote down music for. Oh.
Then they meet the silverback gorilla.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of funny. I think one of the sidekick guys, or the sidekick geek, tries to take a photo of the silverback gorilla and his shutter is closed. And he just, like, pretends to take a photo and walks away.
Does that happen?
Yeah, there's a shutter on his...
I don't remember that. I did write down that there's a kind of a role reversal here, because for the first time, Elliot actually isn't a sniveling wuss. And for the first time, Monroe, who is Ernie Hudson, actually is a little bit of a coward. Because like Ernie Hudson starts telling him, oh, I know about the jungle, and what you're supposed to do with the silverback is not to run away. And he's like, yeah, dude, I'm a primatologist. But he's really scared, but he stands there, and, you know, it works. And then he turns around, and Ernie Hudson is totally scarpered.
Yeah.
And I thought that was funny. And then he stands up and goes like, sorry, I ran away. Apologies. And he's like, he's completely back to normal. He's not embarrassed at all. He's such a good character.
It's really cool. Really funny.
Yeah.
We're on to a hippo attack. I get, like, when we're on this expedition, we're just really seeing a nice kind of cross-section of all the things that happen in the jungle, really, I suppose. So,
again, these are very old tropes from books and movies, like, gotta have the animal attack scene, gotta have the, you know, the pygmies or the
tick,
natives. Tick, yeah, ticking the boxes tick. A little bit. And, again, it's a bit like Pirate Latitude. You know, Crichton is clearly, all this is taken from the book, by the way, but Crichton is having fun by updating an old genre. And sticking in all the fun, silly things that you'd see, like, in an old movie.
Mm.
That's what I think.
So they're attacked by hippos, I guess, and all their equipment survives, and, like, somehow.
Yeah, it looks pretty unlikely.
And then we kind of witness... Is there anything...
They find the city next.
Yeah, the thing I had written here was they do experience the plane crashing, which is the third expedition sent by
Travis. He's not having any luck with this, is he?
No.
In the book, that plane crash is not anything to do with his company. It's a rival company that has been... They're trying to beat this rival company to get to the diamonds before they do.
It's a travesty.
Whoa.
No. I really like this... Seeing the plane crash for the fact that any of these kind of Heart of Darkness stories and that we see brought to life on the silver screen, things like Apocalypse Now, when they're traveling through the jungle and you're just seeing nothing but jungle for a long time, and then you kind of come across that French colonial settlement.
Yeah.
I'm sure do you remember that. I really like those things. It's like you're so far into the middle of nowhere, but still, like, you can still be in touch with, there's still something here, there was something going on here.
Some connection.
Ages ago, or else you can see the plane flying overhead, you know, that can get in as deep as you are without even trying as hard as you have just tried. There's something there anyway for me, but
cool.
I don't know if it's worth talking about anymore.
So, yeah, they find the plane obviously comes in handy later on. They get some supplies from it. Actually, there's a weird moment where Ernie Hudson is like, no, don't even go in there to check. Everyone's dead. And it's like, well, you don't know that. You know, somebody might have survived. But anyway, he doesn't think they need to waste time checking for dead people.
Did you say something has survived? Is that a bit of foreshadowing, maybe? I wrote a note here. We're going to call... Well, I'm going to call the evil gorillas. Would you have a name for them?
I don't. I'm excited to hear what your name is.
Oh, well, so we have the mountain gorillas and the silverback gorillas. And I call these evil gorillas the congorillas. It's a bit lame, but...
Okay, we can call them that.
At least we can...
So then they find the lost city. What did you think of that?
The lost city of Zinj.
Yes.
Well, it's...
It's a funny word, Zinj.
Zinj. It seems that I'm dealing with the last notes of Zinj here because I've come to the end of my notes. I think I've given up. I think I decided. All right, well, they found the city.
It's all over now.
I think this is...
Everyone can go home.
This adventure is going to wrap up exactly how I think it's going to wrap up.
They'll find the diamonds. Everyone will be rich. Go home. Nobody dies. No apes. They'll get back and Travis will be like, so what was up with the ape? And she was like, no, that was nothing. here's your diamonds.
I like the city. Again, they find it very easy for something that's hard to find. But then again, Tim Curry is a buffoon. So
a buffoon? Oh, yes. You mean like it's, considering he had such difficulty finding it on other occasions?
Yeah, I can picture him as
this. Isn't there a bit where Ernie Hudson says... You know, you went looking for this city before, and you went in with all these people, and they all died, and you were only carried out of the jungle by, as I remember, me.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which is like, why does it take him so long to recognize Tim Curry when he first meets him? Because when they're in the truck, he's like, don't I know you from somewhere? And he's not sure.
Because he's so busy with his adventures, he has a new adventure every 3 days.
But like, surely you'd remember carrying this, like, Romanian guy out of the jungle. So yeah, I like the city because... I don't know, I felt like the sets were not over the top. There wasn't lots of, like, ridiculously big CGI stuff. It felt kind of low-key and kind of realistic. And there's a lot of good tension as they're, like, prowling through the city, and you kind of know something's out there, but you don't know what it is yet.
Yeah, like, I liked the city, but I would have liked to have known a bit more about what was going on there. I mean, they find hieroglyphics, but Solomon, or King Solomon, was supposed to be a king of the Israelites, so there wouldn't have been any... Egyptian.
Yeah, I mean, they don't really get into that much. They just kind of assume that you know who Solomon was and where he lived and all. And it's like, well, they don't... It's very far away. Congo is very far away from, you know, Egypt or Israel or anywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I would have liked to know more about that too. Anyway, there's another great subversive moment when they're inside the city and who's been left waiting outside? Only Side Geek. And... And one of the porters.
You want to start that again?
So, while everyone is exploring on the inside of the city, two people are left guarding outside, and they are Sidegeek and one of the porters, who turns out to be called Claude. And the Sidegeek is like, oh, that's an unusual name for someone from Mombasa. And Claude is like, have you ever been to Mombasa? And he says, no. What do you know about it? And it's like, another one of those moments where the movie is like, don't pretend like you know or know what to expect from people just because of where they're from, mm-hmm. you know, and like, if you know anything about the colonial period, it's like, it makes perfect sense that he might have a French name or that he might speak English, but like, this American guy is like puzzled and confused by everything, and Claude is a bit ruder to him than he probably needs to be, but it's a good moment, you know, again, about expectations.
Yeah, and I mean,
presumptions.
Both of us have lived abroad, and you've probably experienced it just as I have, people like expecting certain things from you because you're Irish.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, it's an example of this movie reaching into more interesting places than most of the script wants to go. There's just quite a few weird moments like that.
Yeah, but it works, like, it's fine.
Yeah. So they start being kind of stalked by the apes, and there's evil apes in the city. And at first, you don't really see them full on. They like attack in the dark and stuff. And I like the scene where, you know, they're in the camp and they've got the laser fence around it, and they brought some amount of stuff into the jungle. Like, there's tripods with guns on them.
these apes, by the way, to me, they look like a cross between Harry and the Hendersons.
Yes.
And like an old person, but I guess they're supposed to be inbred.
Yeah, but they do look like they all have grey hair and like wrinkly faces and like one eye and.
Yeah, are they supposed to be inbred, or are they just supposed to be like very aggressive?
I think they just
each other?
They want they're all the effects were done by Stan Winston, and I think Stan just wanted to make them look evil, scarier than regular gorillas. It's mentioned that they are bred for certain traits. So kind of like you would breed a dog, you know, the way like all dogs are actually the same species, right? Okay. Even though they look different, and people have bred them to emphasize different things, like to make them big or small, or so they have little pug faces or long ears or whatever. So obviously the people who were running King Solomon's mines back in the day bred gorillas to emphasize, you know, their ferocity and their loyalty and stuff, and maybe some physical traits went along with that, like making you look like Harry the Henderson's grandfather.
I see.
Actually, in the book, it's explicitly mentioned that the way the apes kill intruders to the mines is using these stone paddles that they carve, and they crush people's heads with them.
Really?
Yeah. Which sounds really... It's really hard to imagine. Like,
yeah.
Like, can you imagine an ape doing that? Like, he would have to stand up on his hind legs, and then he'd be really slow, probably, at moving. And I have difficulty visualizing that.
Yeah, and also, like, how many visitors would have arrived at the mines for them to have evolved that sort of weapon, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, they're taught to do that by the people.
Oh, right, okay.
But that's a good point, and, like, for how many hundreds of years have the apes continually, you know, bred and taught new generations to be horrible and vicious and kill everyone? When no one really comes to the city, presumably.
Now, I suppose they do mention that there was a number of expeditions that went there, and I think six of them never came back or something like that.
Yeah. There's a nice bit where Amy goes missing, and Peter is like, I gotta go find Amy. And then Munro is like, people come first, then gorillas. Do you agree? And he's like, okay, yes, I do. That sounds sensible. And then instead of behaving like stupid chicken-headed Hollywood characters, everyone behaves like sensible adults. Like, Peter is like, yes, I do want to get Amy, but you're right. People come first. And Monroe's like, yes, I appreciate that you're concerned about your ape. We will deal with that, but we're going to do this first.
Yeah.
And I like him. He's a good leader. Like,
That ties into some of the maturity in the script that I kind of mentioned earlier. Like, I mean, Tim Curry comes out and explains why he's going there, and everyone's just like, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, nobody cares.
Yeah.
It's like, the movies just always have characters hiding their motivations.
Yeah.
And there's not really always a reason for it.
Yeah. And, I think in any other movie there, if Tim Curry said that, like, he'd be bound in rope, you know?
Yeah.
Tied up and, you know, gagged before the next scene kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know?
So they find the mines and they fight off tons of apes.
Yeah, and
what do you think of the apes? Do you think they look stupid or do you think they're scary?
It's a tough question. I think when I say they look stupid, I don't think they look stupid fake, but I think they just look kind of snaggle-toothed and they're just
Do you think, like, they're a bit over the top in how evil they are? How, like, do you think they could have just used kind of regular looking gorillas that were just a bit bigger or a bit meaner?
Yeah, yeah, I think they could have.
Because they're all goofy colors and, yeah, and snaggle tooth.
I suppose there is that kind of almost, is it Deliverance vibe by their inbredness, you know?
I guess, yeah, maybe. That didn't occur to me.
Another Heart of Darkness.
Kind of. Yeah, I guess that could be a thing. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, and you kind of arrive and they have that evilness. Yeah, yep. I suppose that's what I got from it anyway.
So I've written down that I kind of thought the ending was a bit lazy. Like, from this point on, the movie just wraps up and is kind of an autopilot. Like the,
just like my notes.
Just like, and my notes end at this point too. I didn't have much to say. There's Tim Curry gets his comeuppance for being greedy, even though he hasn't really done anything evil.
Yeah, like, I mean,
he's, I mean, a theme of the movie is like about greed, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, Travis gets punished in the end for his greed because he doesn't care about his son. He just cares about getting diamonds.
Yeah.
And Tim Curry gets punished for his greed.
Yeah. And
Presumably the people in the mines who got slaughtered by the apes back in the day when they rebelled or whatever, they were punished for their greed.
Yeah. And was anyone else punished?
I think that's plenty of punishing for one movie.
There's a few innocent victims in this, I suppose.
Few people get punished for being like geeky sidekicks, which is always a sin.
Yeah, he was being punished for not realizing why Claude was, a common name in Mombasa. Yeah, take that. So I guess they do find the diamond mine in the end with all the gorillas there, and we do see the diamonds, and there's a big geode that they climb into.
Yeah,
and
geode, yeah.
Bruce Campbell is there for some reason. And they manage to construct a laser with one of the diamonds, and they...
I imagine it's like Bruce Campbell's own laser that he had at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wraps up very quickly. They fight some apes, and there's a river of lava, and the volcano erupts.
Yes.
And the whole city gets washed away in kind of bad-looking CGI leather.
Yeah, again, this is something, like, I don't know what a disaster like that would look like in real life, so I'll take that CGI.
Yeah, I guess it's not bad, it's just, it's kind of unimaginative.
Yeah.
It's like jungle movies or Lost World movies always end with a volcano and everything gets destroyed, you know? Like, that's a really old trope, and... Also, like, I was really interested in the build-up to, like, finding the city and what's the mystery of the apes. And then it's kind of like, so what, you know? Nobody has any interesting revelations at the end. Nobody learns anything really about humanity or whatever. And I just needed a little something more.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about the book?
And, it's very similar, yeah. It really kind of runs out of steam in the last few chapters and all the same things happen.
Jeez.
Yeah. I did like the scene where Peter lets Amy back into the wild and he's really sad at the end.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I do remember that. And, yeah, it's fine, I guess. And there's a couple of things at the end. So in terms of not goofs, but like factual mistakes, I mean, she puts that laser into... like a reverse laser or something.
And, I don't understand what you said about that at all.
And blows up his satellite, basically.
Yeah, I don't know how she has the power to do that, but she does.
Yeah, and I'm sure if the guy is as loaded as he is, he'll just be able to get another satellite.
Also, what about the like thousands of people who work for him who are now going to be out of a job?
They're being punished as well, aren't they? apparently all she has like is the battery in her backpack to power this gigantic laser that shoots through the sky and blows up a... yeah.
Again, I didn't really like that subplot because I just thought that Travis was like a cartoon bad guy who just like was so greedy he didn't care about his son dying. I didn't buy that.
It's a bit
I
think he could play a good Donald Trump, maybe.
Yeah, he's a bit of a Trump, actually, isn't he?
Yeah.
And then they all escape in a balloon that they found in the crashed airplane.
Yeah, why would that have even been in there? I mean, like,
it does kind of make sense that because it's a Travicom vehicle that she would know what they'd be carrying, though.
True.
I that was good. I mean, at least that wasn't completely stupid.
Kind of reminds me, well, I guess the only connection there between, you know, the animated movie Up,
where yes,
go to, like, on a similar expedition into the...
Yeah. The flat plateaus of South America.
Is it okay to call it the Dark Continent? Is that, like...
Well, they're in South America in Up.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true, yeah. But I guess it's, Into the Jungle.
I believe Michael Crichton calls it the Dark Continent on the very first page of the book, right here. So if it's okay for him, it's okay for you.
Mm. And they're flying away in their balloon. It is a very kind of turn of the century.
Yeah, it's very Jules Verne kind of a thing to do.
True.
And given as it's an update of like one of those kind of 19th century books,
mm-hmm.
I guess it kind of works.
Yeah, so I like that. Interestingly, the Captain Sesame Cake. You know Captain Sesame Cake? Yes.
Why didn't we call him that earlier when we couldn't think of his name?
Captain Leopold Sesame Cake. He does one of the voices in Up.
No way. Mm. That's a mind-blowing connection.
Yeah, I think he's also in Cider House Rules and a number of other...
Whoa.
Fairly...
He was great. I loved that scene.
Yeah, he's a great actor, all right.
All right, so that's all I have to say about the plot and such.
That's all we got to say.
That's all we have. Would you recommend this?
I would recommend it. I mean, like, you don't have to invest terribly in this.
No.
As long as you can get past the first minute and a half of those awful shots and that awful music, don't be put off by that awful music. Spirit of Africa.
So that's Congo.
That's Congo.
What should we tackle next?
I don't know. Do you want to go for Sphere?
Ooh, I might have a hard time tracking that down, but I'd like to watch it, yeah. That was also one of my favorite books.
Oh.
Yeah, big time.
Okay, well, I don't think next week is going to work for me to do Sphere, but I'm on holidays for a week, so I can read two books.
Ooh.
Two Michael Crichton books.
Well, whatever you read, we will watch.
There's a movie I really want to watch, and that's The 13th Warrior.
Yes.
I'd also love to watch Timeline at some stage. But sure. So next podcast we're going to do...
More Crichton.
Let me say Sphere.
Yeah, let's go for Sphere.
All right, let's do Sphere.
Fun times.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening.
See you.
Signing out.